Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Life is Short ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Many years ago, when I was a younger man, early 20s, I would say, I was asked to be a correspondent for E! News. E! And I said, yes! And they sent me, because it was a free trip, anything for a free anything I would do. And it was a free trip to Monaco.
You still do that?
Yeah, no, I know. I don't know. I used the past tense. And they sent me to Monaco. And I remember I interviewed Patrick Duffy. And I got to meet, I think I interviewed him, Prince Albert of Monaco, royalty. And I thought, well, how are they letting me do this? Like, how do I have the credentials? I don't have any credentials except an E badge.
Those are credentials?
Yeah, I guess so. But like,
those are literally credentials.
But I know, but not like professional credentials as someone who had done that before. And he's a member of a royal. I know. I think that now. But at the time, I thought a prince. And he looked like he was very nice. He looked like just like a normal, he looked like a suburban dad. Like he looked like a guy like who would bring his kid to soccer in the town we grew up in.
A regular guy?
He did.
I got news for you. He is a regular guy.
Albert. I know, but
royalty.
At the time,
it's so silly.
Stupid, I know. But at the time, I thought, I was under that impression that like royalty is special and like that. I subscribed to that ridiculous belief.
So what happened?
He was just fine. He was nice and like whatever. Nothing much happened.
That's a hell of a story.
All right, here we go. If you like that, you're going to love the show.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
You're listening to Life is Short. I'm your incredible storytelling host,
Life
Justin Long.
Dream, sweetheart. Do, 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 shaboom.
With me as always is Christian Long, my brother.
You have a better name than I do.
Christian Long.
Justin, not only is it easier to say, but it's Christian. Less overtly embarrassing.
Also,
the name Christian, it just like connotes too much. Connotes.
Denotes. What's the difference?
I don't know.
Uh-oh.
I feel like I don't know anything anymore. I'm pretty sure I'm getting dumber as I get older.
Well, I think, doesn't that make sense? Your brain just degrades. Right? But that's why you got to read and keep
I have been reading. I have been reading.
You know, a great book to read is this book called 10%.
What is that?
Well, it's actually written by our guest today.
Well, that was a quick pivot.
Two pivots. And also the reason that we're talking about correspondence.
Oh, yeah. You were a correspondent for E.
Once. And I think I've already told this, but the other thing I remember doing as a correspondent was falling in front of Donald Trump.
You have told that. Yeah. I will say that story, the Prince Albert story, as stories go, it was a really good setup for a story.
Yeah.
Like,
I know,
you were in Monaco working for E. You were interviewing Prince Albert, and then he was a nice guy. You know, it was a really good start.
I know. That's such a fear of mine. There's a character who does that on
Lotus. You're like Del Griffith.
I know. Who tells these stories like they're going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And you're Steve Martin saying, here's an idea. Next time you tell a story, try to have a point. It makes it so much more enjoyable for the listener.
Anyway, I'm sorry I got you derailed from your really efficient guest introduction.
And a double introduction. I found a way to use him as a writer, because he's a writer. He's a correspondent, kind of like me. He is, one of the huge correspondents, war correspondent, in fact, for ABC News. He's the author of a book that I love called 10% Happier. His name is Dan Harris.
I believe he recently retired from ABC News.
Yes, he was. I should have used past tense. Also, I no longer am a correspondent for E. I should have made that clear. Steve Kometko took over.
But once a correspondent, always a correspondent, you know?
I guess so. I could always say that.
Like Eagle Scouts, you know? Once you're an Eagle Scout, you're always an Eagle Scout.
Yeah. God. I mean, what if you did something embarrassing? Then you're like, oof, never doing that again. Like, would you say like, well, once a foot licker, once a necrophiliac, always a necrophiliac?
You went from footlicker to necrophiliac really quickly.
Well, you know why? Because footlicker is too innocent. No, I was like,
I don't know if it's innocent.
It can be.
Foot licker?
It can be if you're just horsing around. I've like licked feet, just like innocently.
Horsing around?
Just like playing around with your lover or something, like just being silly.
I guess so.
I mean, you'd probably have to be your lover. It wouldn't be, you can't do it to a stranger, just lick their feet. That'd be dangerous.
Yes. So Dan Harris.
Right, right. See, Dan Harris doesn't get derailed this way.
Well, he's a professional.
But he did have a moment that we're going to talk about, like a really intense episode where he was reading a teleprompter on the news and he had a panic attack. He had an anxiety attack that he then started investigating and the causes of it and how to fix it, really. And that was kind of the impetus for this whole new career that he has now as a meditation specialist, someone who created an app, wrote a book about it, and he's been very forthcoming about his experience with mental health and anxiety. And so
you said create an app, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I knew what you were going to say. I knew what you were saying, but it sounded a little bit like you created an app.
Oh, I did?
I don't know. It just sounded mumbly to me.
He wouldn't do that either.
I wanted it to be clear because it's important.
It is an app.
An app.
An app. He created an app, and he has really good diction. Anyway, here.
Anywho.
But
you're
checking with Jerry.
But you've been really inspired by him. You've been doing this app, right? And you have. You speak very highly of not only him, but of meditation in general.
Yes, other meditation specialists on it. I really love Anushka, Joseph Goldstein. There's great people who specialists who lead these meditations, these daily meditations. And yeah, it really has helped me. If you listen to the show, if you listen to more than one episode, you know how I feel about it.
If you know, you know.
Yeah, I talk about it probably too often. So here we go. Let's just get into it and begin and hear from the man himself, Dan, the man.
Did you plan that?
No, I didn't plan saying Dan, the man. do you stand that?
God.
Stan, I'm trying to talk like the millennials. Anyway, this. Oh my God, I just got pitched a commercial to do where basically I'm like the old stuffy guy. That's what the whole point of the commercial is. It's like, and it's like a millennial comes out and it's like, hey, old man, like this is the cool way to do it.
Sad.
I know, but you know, whatever.
Well, you should meditate about it.
I'm going to and embrace that the time moving forward and
live in the present.
Be mindful. And that's what we're going to talk today about with Dan Harris, someone who has really changed my life and someone whom I am always going to be grateful for. So here he is. You'll hear me let him know that several times probably because it really is true. And I appreciate him coming on and talking about it.
Come on!
All right, here he is, Dan Harris.
God.
Life could be a dream, sweetheart. Do, 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 shaboom.
For all the shorties that want voluminous, fanned-out lashes, ooh, this ad is for you. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara creates corner-to-corner panoramic lash volume. Their tapered brush catches every single lash, even those pesky corner lashes. You know who you are, corner lashes. With the Panorama Mascara, you'll easily achieve that effortless, false lashes look. It's one of Christian's favorite looks. Plus, it lasts up to 24 hours and is clump and flake resistant. And just when you thought it couldn't get better, it does. The Panorama Mascara is a lot more affordable than other luxe mascaras. And honestly, it probably does a better job. It's affordable, but it's deceptive because it comes in a premium gold luxe packaging. So if you want a mascara that can do it all, volumize, lengthen, and stay put all day, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. As a podcast listener, I'm sure you know that audio piques the imagination, like especially this show. So if you really want to feel like you're in the story, check out Audible's collection of brand new exclusive thrillers.
Their titles feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. So you'll be kept on the edge of your seat.
Here's an interesting psychological thriller that is out right now. It's an Audible original. It's called Oracle. It follows an FBI psychic who can help solve missing person cases when he touches those close to the victims. But of course, it comes at a cost. He'll see the horrific moments before the victims disappeared.
Shorties, I just got chills. You have to listen along with me. You don't have to.
No.
But I think you should.
Yeah, it'd be fun. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/long or text long to 500-500. That's audible.com/long or text long to 500-500.
Hello, hello again. Shaboom, and up and we'll meet again.
Forgive me if I'm going to be overly familiar with you because you've become such a big part of my life. I see you every day. So this is not at all unusual for me. It's a little surreal. You talk to me a lot, but I never get to talk to you.
That's really cool. I appreciate hearing that. Thank you. What does your shirt say?
Well, so and this is smart. Wicked Smart. Yeah, this is all our Massachusetts guests. I like to wear it. Where are you?
I'm from Newton. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I shouldn't say this, but it's in my head now, and I won't be able to get around it. I lost my virginity to a girl from Newton. I don't know how else to say that.
If that doesn't make it in the show, I'm going to be very upset.
It should. I feel like I've said it before on the show. I promise you it'll be in there. And she knows, and I'm not going to say her name, but she knows who she is. I hope she's listening. Newton, Mass. What a nice, just a nice suburban hamlet, right?
Yeah. It's actually, technically, it is a city. So it has a bunch of hamlets within it, but it's got quite a bit of economic diversity. So it's got like Sumner Redstone lives there, but also there are a lot of housing projects.
That's who I lost my virginity to.
Sumner Redstone.
Yeah.
Is he a generous lover?
Oh, he was really gentle. Yeah. He was, I probably shouldn't have said that. Now I feel like I've diminished Newton. I'm sorry to any listener. Also, is this, do people have the accent there? I mean, is it a strong accent?
Oh, yeah. I just spent a couple of days up in Maine with my son. And I was doing a Boston accent the whole time. It is very strong.
And the Maine is similar, right? But a little bit, I remember them sort of saying, coming up at the end. Do they come up at the end of Maine?
Yes, they do. It's a thicker, slower accent. I cannot do a Maine accent, even though I lived there for 8 years.
Oh, wow.
But I can do sort of like a version of a Boston accent.
But you probably had to wean yourself off of it. I mean, as a journalist, as an on-air anchor, they probably stress a more neutral sound, I would imagine.
You know, I never really had it, to be honest with you, because my dad's from Jersey and my mother was a sort of like upper crusty Bostonian, North Shore New Englander. And she didn't really have a thick accent either. So I didn't have to wean myself out. I had many other changes I had to make in order to be acceptable in public, but not that.
What was the biggest one? Was it was the way you dress? Was the way you presented yourself?
Well, my mentor when I was new at ABC News was this guy, Peter Jennings, and he used to constantly torment me for having horrible fashion.
Well, I grew up, Peter Jennings to me was like the epitome of what it meant to be a man, like a solid, authoritative person. He was so impressive. And I read your book. I love this book, 10% Happier. And you go into some really hilarious detail about that the dynamic that you had with him and how respected, but also how feared he was as a boss, just as a boss. I never thought of him that way. He was on my TV. He delivered the news. What was that experience like? If you can distill it, the detail is so great in the book, but what was it like to work with him?
Complex character. Yeah. I loved Peter. I idolized him my whole life until I met him. And still, when I met him and saw the many aspects of his personality, I still idolized him. He was so smart, so brave, so smooth, so urbane. Yeah. I loved him and he changed my life. I was this schlubby, very youthful looking kind of plankton who came up from local news, arrived at ABC News when I was 28, didn't know anything. God. And he sent me all over the world, man. And it changed my life. And he was really cranky and could be pretty mean. And I sometimes described it I described it in the book as being thrilling in the way putting your head into a tiger's mouth is thrilling, not yes. safe.
Yeah.
So being in his orbit, he would just say things to you that were really cutting. Or like, I remember one day I walked downstairs to his office I was wearing this plaid jacket, which was, in hindsight, it was a very ugly jacket. But he looked at me as like, oh, yeah, you're going to wear that on television? And he just
just really dry, because he was Canadian too, right? So he probably had a really dry delivery.
Yes. Another time I was standing in Iraq 130 degrees, probably. No, probably like 120 degrees, honestly, in Baghdad after the war. You know, the war had just ended, but the insurgency was about to begin. And I was doing a live shot, and he got in my ear right before the show started. It was I really think you need to be, you know, wearing suit and tie.
Oh, no.
And I was like, dude, first of all, why are you commenting on this before I'm doing a live shot and I haven't slept, you know? And second, you know how hot it is here. Was the kind of thing he would do.
Well, was it to throw you off course? Do you think it was deliberate? Was it, or was it purely, it was in his head and he needed to say it? Or was there any kind of, do you think, subconscious motives for it?
I think that yes to all of it. I think the more I learn about the way my mind works, and I think the way the mind generally works, is that there are often many levels of contributing motivations to any given action. And so with Peter, I think on the benign end of the spectrum, he really, you know, he wanted to take care of me. He wanted to see me succeed. On the other hand, I think he also wanted to see if I could take a fastball. And I think he had a tortured relationship with some of his own mentors and so maybe didn't learn the best, interpersonal hygiene.
Who do you think Peter Jennings' mentors were? Would they be like Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow, like the heavies that you would imagine?
I was watching last night, actually, with my wife, a documentary that I found to be really triggering, fascinating, but very triggering for me. It's called Mike Wallace is Here, and it's about the great 60 Minutes newsman, Mike Wallace. It's available, the documentary, on Hulu. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying that because I work for Disney and Disney owns Hulu. It's, I would have, no matter where it was available, I would recommend it. And it was eye-opening because it just reminded me how this older generation of news, mostly men, so newsmen and a few women, they were really mean to each other. It was hyper competitive. And Rune Arledge, who was the president of ABC News, developed a star system. So he had Peter Jennings, Hugh Downs, Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer, Ted Koppel, David Brinkley, and they pitted them against each other. And so when I got to ABC News, it was a really hostile place. And if you were friends with Peter, if he was considered one of Peter's boys, then the other anchors might not like you.
And my God.
It was really tough.
Yeah, you described that in the book, again, very hilariously. And that was a surprise to me that it happens, the competitiveness happens within the ranks of that network. I would have thought it was, you know, you'd compete with CBS or CNN, whatever. But you and David Wright, you said you had you're so honest in this book too about, you know, some of these less attractive moments, which I always find really inspiring. And that's what led you to what we'll talk about, which is your focus on meditation. But how quickly did you recognize that environment? How quickly did that become apparent that it was this cutthroat, competitive atmosphere?
Very quickly. Even as I was doing interviews for the job, one of the executives sat me down and said, they were auditioning me to anchor this sort of fun overnight show that they have that was at the time anchored by a guy named Anderson Cooper. Yeah. And I remember this executive sat me down and was like, I could see you doing this, but I could never see you being a correspondent, like a real journalist. That was just the type of shit that came out of people's mouths all the time.
And how do you respond to something like that?
How did I respond?
Yeah, you have to just take it, right?
I was so desperate to have the job that I just said, yeah, okay, fine. I think I probably agreed with him. You know, I was so young. What did I know?
I'm the worst. Yeah, you kind of have to just take it, I guess.
I remember another time one of the executives, I had gotten sick, like deathly ill when I was covering. You remember Howard Dean ran for president in 2004?
Yes.
The night of his scream, I got a flu and I had to stay in Iowa for like a week and I had to go to the hospital. I was really sick and I got back to the main headquarters in New York. And one of my boss said, you know, getting sick like that, it's a bad look for you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Any sort of weakness.
Yep.
Oh my God, that's terrifying. So that's the high pressure environment that you're in. And that's kind of like the jumping off point for your book. I just want to talk about the pressure a little bit more. And I found all of this so fascinating. When you went overseas, you became a war correspondent, and which must have been a Dream. What did that feel like to get to go over there? And what kind of fear did that instill in you?
It was way more thrilling than I thought.
Uh-huh.
I had no ambition. I never crossed my mind, even as I was working my way up through local news stations and then got to ABC News. I never really had any ambition to be a combat reporter.
Really?
At all. I just hadn't really thought about it. And then 9/11 happened and I immediately wanted to go overseas to cover whatever was going to happen next. And yeah. I think there were a couple motivations. One was idealism. You know, I think it's important to have people like at the tip of the spear, witnessing what the government is doing in our name. I think the other reason was curiosity, just like, whoa, what's that going to be like? And then the third was ambition, raw ambition, really wanting to move up in my chosen field. What I did not foresee was that in these environments where you are really at risk, you're being shot at and there are bombs going off, that it's exciting. I wouldn't want to do it now that I have a little, you know, I'm 50 and I've got a little kid and I would not never do it now. But in my early 30s, it was totally thrilling. And that is a drug.
That's what you, that was interesting too. And your mother, there's a great quote, I think it's from your mother, about the ego aspect of it, about the idea of just being of fame and being successful in that environment. I forget exactly what she says, but it's...
I had this off. My mom is an incredibly brilliant woman who was a pioneering academic physician at Harvard and just quite an intimidating presence. And, and somebody I really look up to and respect. And I remember her saying something offhand in my youth, at some unspecified point in my youth, that anybody who would run for president or want to be famous must have some unfillable hole at the core of their being. Yes. And that was on my mind sometimes when I realized that I really wanted to be a famous journalist. Like, what's wrong with me?
I bet. Well, you're so honest about that. And I'm sure it's something that everyone, I think that about politicians as well. There is, you can't get away from that, that there is this, there is an ego aspect to it, a wanting to be seen. You talk about people on the Jumbotron at a baseball game, how excited they get.
Yes.
And how most people have a little bit of that in them. And I never thought of journalists or, you know, correspondents as having that, but it makes sense that they would.
Scale the dopamine hit that you get from showing up on the Jumbotron or having people like your Instagram post.
Right.
Scale that to infinity. And that's what it's like to be on the television on the regular, especially in a war zone, you know?
And to have Peter Jennings saying, our man in Afghanistan.
Yes.
That
yes.
you're that man. You're the guy on the ground.
Yes.
Was it, did that kind of overwhelm any of the fear in terms of getting, you talk about getting shot at, which is something that very few people have experienced. What was that like?
It did overwhelm the fear in many cases. Uh-huh. You know, it's like, I think I used this example, but I don't know if you ever notice there's a difference between your experience of a thing when you're filming it with your iPhone than when you're actually just there.
Totally. Yeah.
So when you're covering news like that and you're just driven by getting the story and doing a good job, I found that I wasn't as worried about normal sane things to worry about, like, am I going to die today? I mean, yes, I did have those concerns and I didn't have a death wish or anything like that, but I was so motivated by the other things, the idealism, the curiosity, the ambition, the thrill of it, that I often really didn't get scared much. And I say this as a dyed in the wool scaredy cat. you know, I've had anxiety my whole life. I had to go to a shrink when I was a little kid because I was so worried about nuclear war. So I had no previous track record of bravery. But in this case, I wasn't terrified all the time.
And you, even when you first got the assignment, so you talk about this, you talk about telling your father and the reaction that he had, which I thought was really, I think probably typical of someone who cares about their son. He cried. He was scared. Did a reaction like that give you pause, or were you so eager to go that it was, again, it was just kind of your ambition drove you?
It did give me pause. And man, if my son ever did to me what I did to my parents, I would be distraught. It did give me pause when I called him to tell him I was going in. It was the first time I was going into a war zone. I was in Pakistan, but I got an opportunity to embed with the Taliban, who were then in control, now also in control.
God, what is
right before they fell. Sorry, what were you going
to
say?
Sorry, Dan. What is that like to know that? I mean, this is, you're talking about an event 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we know that they've seized power again. How does that feel? Just as somebody who was personally involved in that story, what, how does that feel to see that happen again?
It's sad and scary.
Yeah. You know,
it's I'm just scared for, I mean, these were, they were not responsible leaders, to say the least.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows what they're going to do now. It's terrifying for all the people in Afghanistan and the wisdom of the foreign policy move and all that other stuff. I'll leave to people who are more nuanced thinkers than me, but just the raw brute facts of the situation, yeah, for people who live there, that just sucks.
It does. And something you said struck me about there are kids who are fighting that war, kids on both sides. But
yes,
you talked about some of the Taliban that you were embedded with as just being kids. They were curious. They were teaching you swear words.
Yes.
They were, yeah, there was a lightheartedness to them that I thought was really interesting. How much did that shape the way you saw that country, the people there, and what was happening to them?
You know, having had the opportunity to travel all over the world.
Yeah.
In heightened situations, how normal things often are.
Right.
I mean, you still have to eat. You still have to go to the bathroom. You still, you know, people still make jokes.
You still gossip. You're still curious, yes, about other. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, the Taliban, they look fearsome in still photos.
Yeah.
But if you're hanging around with them, many of them are just young kids with no other opportunity who were just doing this thing because that's what their dad did or whatever. I probably, the higher you go, I didn't hang out with Mullah Omar. I'm sure he was genuinely
right,
terrified.
He probably wasn't a big laugh.
No, no, and yeah, I definitely wouldn't be sharing bar mitzvah stories with him.
Right. Right. Oh my God. My aunt got me the weirdest thing. Yeah. But it must have been to have lived in America, to have never seen anything like that. I'm just so fascinated by that experience, what that must have been like, just to get shot at. I mean, just the idea of being, you talk about, you describe it as like a whistling noise, just the noise of it, the sounds, the feel. When were you scared? When were you like, oh shit, this could be like a death situation?
Definitely. I mean, there were absolutely, I don't want to portray that in moments where you hear whistling overhead of a bullet going over, that I didn't have fear. I absolutely did have fear. And there were moments, I remember being in, so after I covered Afghanistan, there was a second intifada in Israel, Palestine. And I spent quite a bit of time in a city called Ramallah, which is where the headquarters of the PLO is or was. And the Israelis invaded, and I was, some bunch of journalists, we were all holed up in this house together. And there was a very experienced war correspondent who was with us. And I remember she had an eye patch because her eye had been knocked out in Sri Lanka. Her name was Marie Colvin. There was actually a movie made about her not long ago.
Yeah.
And I remember her running into the room and because they were shelling buildings on our block. And
oh,
I remember
God.
Her running into the room and saying, "This is bad." And there were plenty of moments where I was really scared. Or I remember driving a car through Ramallah at one point, and I saw an Israeli tank, and the turret started slowly turning toward us.
Oh my God.
And so absolutely, I am not immune to that at all. But I think the Winston Churchill say, or he's purported to have said, that there's nothing more thrilling than the bullet that misses you.
Right.
And so once the bullet misses, you're like, you know,
yeah,
I write about this. My first thought is, are we rolling on this? Like, this is good stuff.
Yeah, that's a badge of honor. And your fellow correspondents joke about how when you go back to America, you're going to be celebrated, or you're going to be, you know, at least using it at bars to boost your social standing.
Well, I'm still dining out on this shit. Like, you're
right.
Impressed. And like,
I am.
So I get to talk about
this.
It's stuff
working.
I'm 50 years old. This stuff happened many, many years ago. I still
right.
get to get the, so yes, there, if you want to stay on the, and I'm always happy to do this because I love talking about the whole catastrophe of the human mind. Like, the crass side of this is real. It is
yep.
absolutely real.
Do, 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 shaboom.
In an effort to balance my sleeping schedule, which is, the older I get, it's become that much more important for me to get a good night's
sleep. I've been doing it with Plus CBD. It's been the best. It's been really like my go-to product for adjusting my sleep schedule and getting like a really good full night of sleep. If you are in a similar boat, you might want to check out Plus CBD. It's formulated by a team of medical experts and doctors. So it's not just some, I know there are a lot of products out there now, but they actually work with experts, people who know what they're doing.
They taste great. The gummies taste
they
great.
Do.
And they're made with award-winning CBD. It's combined with melatonin, magnolia bark, and lemon balm. We've tried three different kinds of gummies. The calm gummies, which are great during the day if you need a little relaxation.
Yeah, that's right. You can do it during the day.
The sleep gummies. And if you're feeling a little
cheeky,
there's the Reserve Collection, which in addition to the CBD has 2.5 milligrams of THC. They're fun.
And if you're not, if you don't have a lot of experience, but you've been curious about THC, and it's a nice dosage to start with.
It's a very mild amount.
But it's still fun. You still feel it. It's a giggly, fun time right before you get a nice night of sleep.
Visit pluscbdoil.com and enter promo code LONG for 40% off your order. You won't regret it.
Oh, man. I've been traveling. My favorite new way to travel is by putting on my sweats, my Vuori sweatpants on the plane. It's so nice. You just get to a little break.
I wear the Vuoris everywhere.
Yeah, I always think you're going to the gym. You're wearing them now. Well, you went to the gym today, and you did other things like leisurely things.
I did it all.
You did it all, and you did it all in your Vuoris.
Sure did.
I'm looking at them.
I'm a walking example of how great this product is.
It's funny. Every time I saw you in Vuoris before this, because you recently started going to the gym, you hadn't been going to the gym for a long time. But I'd see you in your Vuoris and assume that you were going to the gym. But
I like giving off that assumption.
Yeah, but now you're actually doing it.
I am.
And you can go. I mean, you just, we have a meeting coming up. I assume you're not going to change. We have
no
Zoom
way.
Meeting, because they look great. They look great no matter what you're doing. They're built to move and sweat in, yes, but they also have a cool look.
They break down the boundaries of traditional activewear. So I would say they're a new perspective on performance apparel.
I think you would say that?
Yeah, that's safe to say.
Well, their mission is to create quality products without extra waste. We should have led with this. They offset 100% of their carbon footprint. So you can feel good about wearing them.
Get 20% off your first purchase at Vuori.com/long.
That's Vuori, which is spelled Vuori.com/long. And you get 20% off. Again, good gift.
Hello, hello again. Shaboom and up and we'll meet again.
You've had all these traumatic experiences that you were not really dealing with then, right? You come back to America and then what was the next, followed that? I mean, what led you then to what you're doing now?
So after 3 or 4 years of covering wars in Afghanistan and then Israel, Palestine, and then also in Iraq. And Iraq was really where I made my bones. I spent a lot of time there. Months and months and months. I came home in the summer of 2003 after a 5 or 6 month long sojourn in Iraq, which spanned the pre-invasion, and then much of the beginnings of the insurgency. And that was just the first time I went. But I came home that summer and I started to get depressed, although I didn't know I was depressed. And so I was really feeling logy and tired and run down, sort of flu-ish for months. And I had all these tests done, and I would make my parents were both physicians. I would make them try to help me figure out what was going on. And one night in the middle of this period, a friend of mine offered me some cocaine, which I was 32 or 3. I'd never done any hard drugs. And I don't know why. I just said yes. Uh-huh. And it made me feel better. This is not a recommendation for cocaine, by the way.
No. We'll be right back.
Yeah, exactly.
They are one of our sponsors.
Right.
So if you could not talk about the negative effects, that'd be great. Yeah, but no, I love the way you describe it. It's also like you're such a great writer, so eloquent that like just that the feeling that the drip, I think you call it like an ammonium taste, the ammonia taste, that's the drip. And then 15 seconds later, it kicks in. And just that shot of serotonin. But then you talk about the depletion afterwards, the next day, which is, my friend calls the blues. You talk about how you blues very hard.
Yeah, I mean, there's no free lunch. If you want to synthetically squirt, all these happy chemicals into your brain that this, there's going to be a, yeah, at least for me, there were consequences and they were deeply unpleasant.
Yeah. Yeah. And would you say it was worse on, because you talk about doing ecstasy, MDMA and stuff. Was that worse? Does that deplete your serotonin
yes.
even more?
For me, it was worse. You know, you just feel awful and depleted and sad. And yeah, that's what led to the panic attack.
It was an on-air panic attack. I hadn't seen it until I read your book. And can you describe to people what exactly happened? I'm sure you're sick of talking about this, but it really is so interesting. And it's led you to all of this great work.
I'm happy to talk about it. There's another story I've been dining out on for a long time. I'm happy to tell it. The video.
Well, it's a classic.
It's a chestnut. Yeah. If you look at the video, many people's response to the video, which if you just type panic attack on television, it's, I believe, the first response, which is great for me.
Did you ever think you'd be encouraging people to watch it?
No. I mean, I was so ashamed after it happened. So ashamed. It's like the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me. And that includes like wetting my bed as an 11-year-old at summer camp, which I, you know, like had to like burn the sheets.
It was we're going to talk about that next. That was my next question.
Put that down. Let's get it all out here now. I'll send you, you can send me a bill afterwards for the therapy. I was filling in as the newsreader on Good Morning America. So the newsreader is the person who comes on at the top of each hour to read a few headlines. We don't have this job anymore, but back then it was done by Robin Roberts, who's now the main host of the show. Robin was off that morning, so I was filling in for her. I had done it many times before, so I wasn't nervous per se going into the gig, and I hadn't been high recently. So mm-hmm. I had no reason to foresee what was about to happen, which was that a few seconds into my shtick, I think I was supposed to read 6 or 7 short stories off the teleprompter. A few seconds after saying good morning, I don't know what happened first. Either my mind started to say, dude, you're nervous, or my body just started to react in some way. But my heart started racing, my lungs seized up, my palms were sweating, my mouth dried up. And then my mind started freaking out because of the body being in mutiny mode. And that made the body worse and that made the mind worse. And I tried to soldier through it. But you can see if you watch the video, I'm like having trouble breathing. My face has gone pale despite the makeup. You can hear my like throat is constricted and I'm kind of gulping a little bit. And a few seconds into it, I just throw it back to the main hosts of the show, Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson, say, you know, back to you guys. I quit basically in the middle. And if I hadn't had the opportunity to do that, then it would have been a total disaster. I would have had to rip the mic off and run away because I felt so horrible.
That would have been the next step, is just to hell with it and running away.
Weeping. I don't know what else fetal is in the repertoire. Fetal position. Yes.
Maybe you shit yourself. Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe you defecate. I love how you call Charles Gibson avuncular. That's such a great word for Charles Gibson. He is avuncular. But of all people to like have that happen in front of, like, forget the millions of people. Because sometimes I think like, okay, that's all conceptual, you know, that the millions of people, you can't see millions of people watching. But like Diane Sawyer, Charles Gibson, to do that in front of that. So what did they think? Were they like, is he having a stroke? What did they have any idea what had happened?
Charlie, I remember, ran out of his seat and ran over to make sure I was okay. And like all this. And Diane was worried. They were all really worried. Yeah. I lied and told them I knew it had happened.
You said it was a bit.
I said it was a bit. Like, you guys, did that joke land or what?
Gotcha. Oh, busted. I'm just kidding.
I mean, I was just really desperate to get out of it, but I knew what had happened. And I remember I went backstage and my mom called me and was like, you just had a panic attack. And then I went to go see a shrink, and that really kind of made things better.
You had to admit to the shrink that you were doing drugs?
Yeah, the shrink asked me a bunch of questions to try to figure out what had gone wrong. I knew I'd had a panic attack. I didn't know the drugs had caused it. And he asked, you know, do you do drugs? And I said, yes. And then he kind of gave me this look that signaled, okay, asshole, mystery solved. And
right. Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. And so I you know, he very much encouraged me to quit doing drugs. I did immediately that day. Yeah. And he said, you know, you got to come see me once or twice a week indefinitely. He didn't think I needed to go to rehab, at least not yet. He wanted to monitor me. And I was able to stay off of it because it was the stakes were so high. I didn't want to ruin my career.
Of course. Yeah. Is it something you miss, Dan? Do you ever have moments where you're like, oh, man?
100%. Absolutely. Yeah. Less because this was a long time ago now of 2004. Yeah. So it's not like I'm walking around craving cocaine. But in those first years, I missed it all the time. Because I loved doing drugs, frankly, and because so many of my close friends, you know, I'd had all these bonding experiences with people and they were still doing it. And it's sort of, I couldn't hang around with them. And so it was really complex. Now that I'm old and all my friends are old, like it's not that big of a deal. But sure. Yeah. I mean, like there's a reason why these drugs become so popular. They do things to the brain that make you feel good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Did something replace that? Would you say meditation replaced that, or is that too simple a diagnosis?
Oh, meditation is amazing, and I will rhapsodize about it. But it's nowhere near as fun on the short term basis as cocaine. So it's not. I think there were some addictive things that kicked in, the sort of like compulsive need to master it, to learn more, and then to become successful at writing a book and then launching a podcast and an app and all that other stuff. I think the addictive stuff is around that.
I see.
I will say that there's one aspect of meditation that I have struggled with as I've become more experienced, which is that concentrating the mind, focusing the mind can, for some meditators, create some very pleasant bodily sensations. There's a technical term for this. P-I-T-I-P-T. It's an ancient word. I think that roughly translates into the rapture. And so in my later years as a meditator recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, as I've gotten better, I don't know if that's even the right word, but as I've gotten more experience at it, there are many times where I sit to meditate and it feels very good. And it's kind of a sort of a less synthetic cousin to MDMA. And I was having a conversation with my meditation teacher recently who was basically kind of doing his gentle finger wagging at me.
Is that Joseph?
That's Joseph Goldstein. I write a lot about in my book.
I love him.
He's incredible and very, very funny. And I was on a retreat with him a couple months ago. He's like, Dan, you gotta move past the rapture. You're like stuck in this. And so I can see my addictive stuff coming around that.
Oh, wow. You're so lucky you get to be mentored by him. I love him. He's got such a calming voice too. I love all of the meditation specialists on the app. But so, what was the thing that led you to meditation? What was the ultimate thing that that got you there?
Wait, hold on one second. Can you say more? Because I'd just be curious, not necessarily about the app or anything like that, but just your experience. How much meditation are you doing, and where? What's the tip of the spear? What's the moment when you really say, "Oh, that now I get it. It's working."
You know what it is? It was whenever I would be triggered by certain things, whether it was somebody cutting me off in traffic or something my mother said that kind of cut deep, or and I would tend to be very reactive. You know, ever since I was little, I would react, and I think what it's helped the most with is that reactivity. Mm-hmm. I think it's allowed me to kind of check in with my breathing and process let the emotions go through me. They sound like small moments, you know, but in terms of my psychological journey, my psychological life, it's had a huge impact. As an actor, I feel it's helped me be a lot more present in a scene. And there's such simple things, but there's things that I think desperately needed. I was meditating just now and a fly kept landing on me. What do you do when that happens? I meant to ask you that. I have this annoying horsefly, and I could hear Sevenet's voice in my head. Okay, breathe, and you know, in and out, and I couldn't avoid the thought of the fly. I guess Joseph would say, make a mental note of it. A fly. Make a mental note of fly on my arm or whatever. So yeah, I would say it's really helped me remain present and mindful, which has been huge. It's had huge effects in my life.
I love hearing that. And I you're absolutely right that to the uninitiated, you know, not losing your temper while driving or not snapping at your mom because she said something to you may sound small, but that compounds. And by the way, it doesn't mean you're going to be perfect at it. 10% is pretty good. But reducing the amount of time that you spend caught in useless anger or rumination or fear is a massive change, really, to the way we live. And the good news, among many pieces of good news, is that you just get better and better at it. This is a skill, and that's what you're doing. Every time you sit down, you're getting better and better at working with your own mind.
I am curious how you came to it.
After I had the panic attack, I was dealing with it through therapy.
Right.
But it kind of set me off on this long and weird, windy journey that ultimately landed on me on meditation. And the probably one of the key moments in there was that a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, recommended that I read a book by a guy named Eckhart Tolle, who is a diminutive elfin German spiritual teacher who's written many, many best-selling books.
Yeah, Power of Now. He is diminutive. Yes. He's elfin.
So his book, like, it was very, very weird. The book I was reading, and I went on to read several of his books, they're very strange and written in this kind of syrupy spirit, new age language that I did not like. But he, in the book, gave this incredibly compelling, to me, description of the human condition. He talks about how we all have this ego or this voice in our heads, which is, you know, just serving up terrible ideas on the regular. Mm. And we, because we're unaware of this nonstop conversation we're having with ourselves, we're owned by it, you know? So we're constantly like checking our email in the middle of a conversation with somebody else, or we're putting our hand in the fridge when we're not hungry, or we're losing our temper when it doesn't make any sense, which probably sounds familiar to you. And that was a huge revelation to me. I realized, oh, okay, this describes my inner experience and it explains my panic attack, the voice in my head, my ego. That's why I went off to wars without thinking about it.
Yeah.
Came home, got depressed, was insufficiently self-aware to know that that was what was going on. Blindly self-medicated with recreational drugs and then just freaked out in front of 5 million people. And that was a huge revelation to me. My hair was on fire about this.
Yeah.
I went and interviewed him. I found him to be incredibly frustrating because I don't think he's full of shit, by the way. I mean, I've interviewed lots of snake oil salesmen and women, and I do not think Eckhart Tolle is one of those people. But he's got a sort of otherworldly diffidence and otherworldly remove that and he makes these claims about how he's imperturbable. And I just couldn't really. It's not that I didn't believe him, but like, I didn't know how that was relevant to my life in any way. And he also didn't say anything that could help me get what he has.
Is it sort of performative, Dan?
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I am as skeptical as they come. And my bullshit meter did not go off with him.
Well, his writing is so compelling. I mean, like you said, I mean, it was compelling to you. So what did you expect? I mean, what did you expect his personality to be?
I wanted him to say, my first question was, what do you do about the voice in your head? You're so right about this.
Yeah.
And he said, take one conscious breath. And the voice in my head was like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, what does that even mean?
I'm glad the voice in your head didn't come out through your mouth.
No, it didn't. But I think my face, which is not, I wasn't able to hide what I was thinking.
You have a good poker face.
I was, you know, asking him this question over and over and over again. He didn't give me an answer that made any sense. I understood the words he was using, but not in the order in which he was using them. And, you know, a friend of mine has described Eckhart Tolle as correct, but not useful.
Oh, and interesting.
It was after meeting him that I then started looking around for somebody who could say something more practical. Go ahead.
So, well, it must be frustrating. So it's like he has he's able to diagnose it, but there's no prescription. Like you're desperately trying to get some sort of prescription from him. And there's just it's just kind of nonsense. Not nonsense, but it's not useful.
Didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
But look, the guy's got millions of followers. So I mean he's doing something right. And I think he's helping a lot of people. I make fun of him gently, but I don't think he's a force for ill or anything like that. It didn't make any sense to me. So I was at wit's end and left to sort of look around.
So, but that stuff, I mean, those are the seeds certainly of, of 10%. I mean, the voice in your head. I love yes. when I get a meditation and they talk about it's that it's a story. Anytime you're any fear that you have, it's just a story.
Yes.
That you're telling yourself. That was always that was very useful to me. That was incredibly helpful. Being present and the idea that the future hasn't happened. So you're wrestling with these things, and you can see it, the benefits of them, but it's a matter of accessing them, putting them into practice.
It was a matter of, yes, exactly right. I mean, I was super compelled by this idea of this voice in the head, this obnoxious inner dialogue, this nattering and yammering all the time, but I didn't know what to do. And then ultimately, after having spent a little time in the darker precincts of the self-help world, which was frustrating, even more frustrating and dispiriting. My wife, or then fiance, and now baby mama and wife, Bianca, gave me a book by a guy named Dr. Mark Epstein, who's a shrink who lives and works in Manhattan, and has written a series of incredible books describing the overlap between Freudian psychology and Buddhism. And I did not know anything about Buddhism. But I was very intrigued by what I read, because it was clear to me that the Buddha, 2,600 years before Tolle started cashing his royalty checks, it was the Buddha who was talking about the voice in the head. He called it the monkey mind. And that we have this mind that is constantly racing, random thoughts, grasping onto things that will not last in a universe that's characterized by impermanence and entropy. Lurching from one hit of pleasant experience, one slice of cake, one latte, one vacation, one promotion, one hookup to the next, without ever being fully sated. Right. And I just thought, okay, this is so smart. And the Buddha had something to do about it, which was meditation.
Of course. Yeah. And was that direct? And so that was the thing.
That was the thing. I read this book by Dr. Mark Epstein.
What was the book, Dan? Sorry.
The book was called Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart.
Okay.
I called him up and I said, will you have drinks with me? And he said, sure. And we went out for a couple of beers, and he was so normal and so fallible, you know, so open about his own flaws, didn't present himself as, you know, some perfected guy. He's just, you know, he's a dad and and an author and a successful psychiatrist. And I was like, convinced, and shortly thereafter I started to meditate. And I think the big piece of it also was that I looked around and saw that there was a lot of scientific evidence that strongly suggests that meditation is good for you, and that was what really put me over the edge.
Well, and you also said specifically that there's now new research being done for in terms of war correspondents, people who had been in your position, and the PTSD that they are suffering. How quickly did you realize that this was something that was beneficial to you?
Immediately. Now, I had to get over my skepticism, because I, you know, meditation, I thought, was, you know, for hippies and weirdos and people who live in a yurt and are really into, you know, John Tesh.
So they can still do it.
Well, you know what? It's sadly, that is not a false stereotype. Like, there are a lot of people like that.
Yes.
But seeing the science really was compelling, how it can rewire key parts of your brain, lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system. It's really good for anxiety and depression. Seeing that science is really what got me compelled. And then the first time I meditated, which I was at a beach house with my wife and some friends, and I sneaked away to a bedroom. I was in the middle of reading a book by the pool, and I went to one of the bedrooms, and I was like, all right, I'm just going to try this. Set an alarm on my BlackBerry, because this was a while ago, for 5 minutes, and I let rip. And, you know, meditation is not complicated. It's, you know, beginning mindfulness meditation is, you know, sit quietly, focus your full attention on your breath coming in and going out. And then every time you get distracted, which will happen a million times, you just start again and again. And a lot of people think when they get distracted that they're failed meditators. Yes, I can't do this. But actually, seeing that you're distracted is proof that you are meditating correctly, because the goal here is to create the kind of self-awareness, otherwise known as mindfulness, that allows you not to be owned by the voice in your head. And I actually kind of understood that going in. So I wasn't discouraged by how distractible I was. I knew, okay, this is like a bicep curl for my brain. And I had seen the brain scans, and the first time I did it, I was horrible at it, and it was humiliating, but I knew I was going to do this.
In what
because
sense?
Because I saw what you see when you meditate is what your life is actually about. You might think, I'm Justin Long. My life is all about being the best podcaster possible and playing roles on in film and television and moving people. And that is true. Your life is about that. It is also from a moment to moment basis. Do I need a haircut? Where do gerbils run wild? What's for lunch? Why did this person get that role that I wanted? Why did so-and-so not call me back? And why is so-and-so ghosting me on text? And why didn't I get more likes on this Instagram post?
It's mostly just gerbils, the gerbil thing.
Yes, gerbils.
Yeah,
well,
yes,
right.
Running wild.
That I'm going to... That's... I'll hold on that. I'll table what? That.
Is that... There's got to be truth to that, right? We can cut this out, but there's got to be truth to that urban legend.
The gerbil thing?
Yeah.
I mean, my wife worked during her medical training in an emergency. She had a rotation in the emergency department and saw lots of crazy things.
Right. I've heard that from friends.
I have not heard any small varmint stories, but the best story that she told me was one day somebody came in. He had somehow, it was a homeless person who had somehow gotten his hands on a prescription pad, and he handed in a prescription. The letters were MOFEEN, 1 pound, take as directed.
That's amazing. Take as directed is the best part. That's amazing.
1 pound.
Did they fill it? I hope they filled it. It is a prescription pad. that's incredible. But yes, I know all of the noise in the head, all of the stories that you tell yourself, I guess. I do want to know about how this has affected you, your day to day. How has it affected your social interactions? I mean, we haven't really been socializing like we used to. But if you go to a cocktail party, for example, do you find that you're... more connected to people? Do you find that you're more present?
Yes. Huh. I'm not infallible here. You know, if with an insufficient amount of sleep or something stressful going on in my life, I had an interaction earlier today where somebody in my house was trying to talk to me and I was kind of beating myself up afterwards for, I wasn't really in the mood and I wasn't as friendly as I should have been. And so
your kid.
It wasn't my kid. It was a house guest. I'm sure there are times when my kid's trying to get my attention and I'm on the phone, you know? And, so I am not infallible, but more often than I used to, I'm able to sort of wake back up and get interested in the person I'm talking to, actually listen to what they have to say, turn down the volume on the me-centered dialogue and turn up the interest in sort of what's happening with you.
Hiring? Well, with Indeed, your search is over because you can get rid of the search and just match. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. That's because Indeed leverages over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day. It's constantly learning from your preferences. Basically, the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/long. Just go to Indeed.com/long right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/long. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Want to hear a really satisfying sound? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations. With Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts, you can start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I've been loving learning Spanish because I love traveling to Spanish-speaking countries, and I just want to be better at communicating with the people. I love the people there, and I want to be able to get to know them better. I also love the food, so I'd like to be better at ordering food so I don't order the wrong thing. They teach you very practical, real-world language skills. And here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/long. Get 55% off at babbel.com/long, spelled BABBEL.com/long. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hello, hello again. Shaboom and up we'll meet again.
I have a quick lightning round, if you don't mind indulging me. Okay. So, you know, clear your head. Don't think. the opposite of what we were saying. What is your most commonly used emoji?
I don't use emojis.
Great. Never, never use one.
Very rarely. Maybe the thumbs up one.
Okay.
Is that right. I use that as one. Like, I like something, like somebody texts me something. Okay. Yes, I'll do it. I give it a like, but I don't put it in the feed.
Okay. All right. Is that, do you do that? Is that deliberately? Are you against emojis?
I'm old, man. Emojis are recent. I'm a late adopter.
I am too. I mean, I'm 43 years old, but I find them really useful in like, establishing a tone sometimes. Like if I text something that might be taken out of context, it, you know, I'll add like a wink or something, like, just so you know, I'm joking, something like that. Anyway, I don't want to sell you on emojis.
No, it's okay. I mean, if you want to be superficial like that, it's your choice, but I...
You know, they have this one. That might be nice for you.
The prayer hands.
If you could be a professional athlete, what sport would you play?
Basketball.
Okay. Knicks? Are you a Knicks fan?
I hate sports, but it was the first thing that came to my mind, and I would like to be tall.
Oh, okay. Like Skilo.
Who?
I wish I were a little bit taller.
Yes.
If you could have one snack food for the rest of your life, what would it be? Your Oreos. Great. They have all different kinds now, I'm seeing. Have you noticed this?
Yes, but I like the originals. They're vegan and delicious. And
Are they?
I once ate so many that I woke up in the middle of the night and puked.
True story. You said that proudly.
Yeah. No, not proudly. But
this will be gross, but what is Oreo puke? Is it just, does it look like what I think it looks?
It looks a little bit like gunpowder.
Yeah. Wow, you might have just turned me off Oreos. That's quite a feat. What was the movie that you were really excited to introduce your kids to that you like couldn't wait to show your kids?
Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you have an order for the first three?
No, they go in order for me. Like, I think the first one, I mean, I think the second one is the Empire Strikes Back, which was the second to be released, even though it's episode 5, is the best. But I still would want to start with the first one, episode 4.
Yeah. And you must remember watching those in the theater.
I do. When I was 7, the first one came out. And my parents used to just drop us off, even if it was in the middle of the movie, and just let us start from the middle and watch it as many times as we wanted, because I just loved it so much.
Oh, God, that's cool. Yeah. The first movies I saw in the theater was Empire Strikes Back. So it had that, to this day, it's my favorite, just because it was my first movie going experience, you know, and I was so young to be watching, because it's dark. There's some really like dark.
This might elements. Explain a lot of your current problems.
I know. Thanks, Dad. what is your go-to karaoke song if you sing karaoke?
It's the same as my favorite emoji.
Okay. I didn't know there was a song called Thumbs Up.
Right. Or Poop. Yeah. I would, if I had to go back, I would pick Poop, because I really do like that emoji.
Right. Yeah. Fun.
I don't think I've ever
really
been to, I've been around karaoke, but I don't think I'm really making myself sound like a terrible person, but I have not really ever done karaoke. I love music, but I have never done karaoke.
No, you're making these questions sound like they're really like kind of lame, cheesy questions. You're making me second guess this whole aspect of the podcast. Who was your first celebrity crush, Dan? Dan is thinking. He's searching his memory.
My favorite celebrity crushes were really rock stars, but they were men. So
that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Anybody. Oh, I know the answer. Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks from Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, yeah, of course. God, Ain't Going Back is a song that I've just been on regular rotation. I love that song. Your Rumors, you would say?
I mean, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow?
Yeah, what's your favorite? What's your go-to? If you could,
what's my favorite? There's a song, I believe it is the first song on Tusk, which is their under-heralded experimental double album called Think About Me. And it is, I believe, no, is that the name of this? Is that the name of the song? I forgot the name of the song. I'm embarrassed by that. It is my go-to song and it's the first song on Tusk. And it has this incredibly, ineffably beautiful guitar part at the end. And my son and I listen to it pretty regularly.
Oh, cool. How old's your son?
He's 6. And his I gave him a musical education par excellence when he was a kid. I was like, he could name which Beatle was singing when I played him a song. Yes,
that's
but now
cool.
he's gotten into Alexa. And he's just listening to, you know, like some DJ named Marshmallow all the time. And so like, that's my life.
Man. Oh man, that must be so disappointing. I wonder that about having kids now, because I would love to have kids, but I think like, God forbid I show them one of those like Star Wars or some music that I loved as a kid. And they're like, I don't get, or they start listening to Marshmallow, but what can you do? You got to just, you can't.
The other day, we were up in Maine and it was evening, like golden hour in Maine, and we were on the dock.
Oh, beautiful.
And we were hurling ourselves off the dock, just me and him in this freezing water. And I had this whole dialogue in my head about like, what a great dad I am doing this terrible thing with this kid. And after like 45 minutes of that, we got out, I toweled him off. We were walking back to our friend's house. It was beautiful. I could hear the crickets, and I paused and I leaned over and I was like, Alexander, I love you. And he looked at me and said, who cares?
Funny. He's funny. You got to be proud of that. Also, in the scheme of things, maybe it was like some Buddhist message. In the scheme of things, you shouldn't hold on to that.
Yes, I think that's right. I had expectations that it was going to be some big moment. And my son, the great teacher, showed me why I had my head up my ass.
Right, that he was going to look back at you and say he loves you, and the strings music was going to swell. But that is that's really funny. If you had to get a tattoo, what would you get and where?
I've been thinking about this recently because my wife and I are thinking about getting tattoos like sort of here. You can't see this. You
on the wrist,
but on the Dan's wrist holding or up the under belly of the forearm. What I want to get is there's a very it's a venerable Buddhist expression or sort of a wish that you can foster, which is that may your actions be to the benefit of all beings. So for the benefit of all beings is the expression. And it's not really my style because I like to have like a wink in everything I'm doing or like some little bit of sarcasm, but I truly do try to develop that motivation, especially since I'm aware of how selfish I really can be. And what I love about Buddhism, what I love about meditation is you can counter program against some of your darker instincts. And I want to develop that motivation more and more.
That is
and
great.
So I thought about putting FTBOB on my wrist as a thing to bring me back to like what I should be operating out of.
Well, Dan, this is a perfect opportunity to marry that with an emoji, because you could do it for the benefit of all beings and then a winky face just to get the wink in there.
What about
the poop? Or the poop, whatever you want, however you want to color it. I think that's really cool. There was one that I want to get. I don't have any tattoos, but I got one. The singer of Green Day, I got drunk with Green Day once. And
really? That's awesome.
Yeah, that's the only cool part of the story. I should just end it there. I got drunk with Green Day. I was so drunk and he couldn't believe it. He was so incredulous that I didn't have tattoos. And he had his security guy give him a needle. I don't know where he got. I'm such a germaphobe. And I was so drunk that I didn't even see where it came from. He just cracked open a pen in this hotel room. And he started stick and poke, like prison style, tattooing a heart on my ankle. And so for years I had this heart on my ankle. See, I told you the story just gets so much less cool.
No, this is actually a good story. I'm with you. Yeah. So what happened to the heart? Is it still there?
Well, it faded. I mean, there's still indentations in my skin, but it faded after a couple of years. My friend said it looked like ringworm at the time. and it wasn't totally connected. It started to look really weird, but it's technically, I guess if there's no ink left, it doesn't count as a tattoo. But Kate, who introduced me to you, and I were doing this movie, and the first AD said, he was this really eloquent British guy. I loved him. He was just really sweet and articulate. And he said, all right, we're going to, he gave a little speech before one day of shooting. And he said, all right, then let's commit it to history. And I just thought that was such a wonderful idea, committed to history. So I think if I got one, it would be that, maybe it's somewhere small. It's been committed. And it was such a great experience, such a transformative experience that I do want to commit it to history. That
maybe maybe the guy from Green Day is available.
Maybe, yeah. And his security guy, Billy Joe. I should get him on the show and talk to him. What is your favorite fruit, Dan?
Bananas.
Okay. That was easy. That was an easy one. Such a useful fruit, too. You don't have to wash it. I love them.
You can eat them in part because I travel to all sorts of difficult parts of the world. You can eat bananas anywhere for that very reason.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, they have their own little packaging.
Yes.
Who would you want to play you in your biopic, the Dan Harris story?
I actually had a very strange experience recently where there have been several attempts to option 10% Happier, and I've usually said no.
Until now.
So I did say yes to, it didn't end up happening, but I did say yes, to one company, and it didn't end up happening, but it would have been this guy named, I didn't choose this actor, but I really did like him a lot personally. It was this guy named Hugh Dancy.
Oh, yes.
Who is way better looking than I am. So I was totally,
that's not true. That he looks like Hugh. He does look like you. Hugh is such a tough name. Must be such a tough name to live with all the, hey, Hugh. That great Curb Your Enthusiasm where he's like, fuck Hugh. yeah, you guys do look alike. For sure, I could see that. Who is your favorite Muppet? I'm sure you grew
Animal,
up watching
the
Muppets.
Drummer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Could probably use some meditation or not. Maybe he's just totally at peace.
I mean, he might be. I mean, I am a drummer. And by the way, just a little quick watching recommendation. There's an amazing new documentary on Netflix called Count Me In. It's all about drummers. And I have been playing drums since I was 10. And it's an awesome documentary. And I want to show it to my son because he wants to learn how to play the drums. And how Animal really has done something that I have rarely succeeded in doing, which is dropping the self-consciousness, dropping the what other people think of you and just going for it.
Yes, that's true. That's true. That I've always struggled with that as well. What's your go-to pizza topping? You mentioned that pizza is still something that you indulge in.
We moved up to the suburbs and there's this local pizza place that makes vodka sauce pizza.
Huh.
So instead of tomato sauce, it's like, you know, penne alla vodka.
Yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
sauce on the pizza.
Oh, wow.
Really good.
Do you prefer dogs or cats?
Cats. We have four.
Four?
Yeah. We just got a fourth. My wife came home with a kitten the other day.
Oh, but did she find it?
She was at the vet with one of the other cats because basically we were at the vet 24/7 and there was a little kitten in the waiting room and she made me come with her immediately go back to see the kitten. I said, let's give it an evening. And that night she submitted before sleeping on it, which was what I had requested, she submitted the application and the next morning we had been accepted and now we have this cat.
So you had to do a slightly longer meditation.
Actually, you know what? I love animals. I would have dogs too. Now that we live in the suburbs, the door is open. I am a huge animal fan.
Do you prefer that? This, I'm really curious about the Beatles or the Stones?
Beatles, but I love them both.
Yes, that's, but if you had to hear, you're at a bar, you have like three songs you can put on the jukebox. They have all the Beatles songs. What do you want to hear?
Dear Prudence.
I was just listening to, I love Dear Prudence.
Maybe Hey Jude, which I wouldn't have picked before, but my son loves it so much that I've really started to warm to it.
I heard a great story about Dear Prudence, which was It was about the Maharajis, yes, when they were studying, yes, with the Maharaj. Yeah. Do you know this,
yes,
this story? Yeah.
Mia Farrow's so sister. Cool. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yes, yes. And it was, I love that they were just like, come outside. We want to fuck. Like, they all wanted to just touch her. And that song like that is just about, and that's what they were concerned with when they were at this spiritual retreat. They were just all trying to like hook up. It's kind of amazing. And apparently that's what Sexy Sadie is about. Yes. Sexy Sadie, yes, was, I didn't know that.
Yes. It was their fuck you to the Maharishi. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. What have you done?
Yeah.
You made a fool of everyone. Oh, amazing. This has truly been such a pleasure.
And, likewise.
And again, like, I don't want to labor the point, but I am such a fan of what you're doing, and it's been such an instrumental part in my life. So huge thanks.
Thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate, yeah, it. It means a lot. And let's keep it going.
Let's keep it going. Okay. And we'll begin again.
Yes.
Wink.
So that happened. So that happened. God, I haven't heard it in a little bit.
It's just, well, it's one of the most neutral voices you could hear.
Yeah. No, it's kind of more. No, it's not really.
It's newsy.
Well, it's a little bit more like this. It's newsy, but very honest. He's very authentic.
You wanted it to be Bostonian.
Yes. No, it wasn't at all.
No.
Well, he talks about that in his book, that he worked that out. He like got rid of that.
He's from Newton,
yeah,
Mass.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, as is the girl you lost your virginity to.
Oh, did I say that?
Sure did. That's how you started the interview.
You know what's crazy? I said that at a dinner party the other day. Whenever Newton, Mass.
Why are you touting this so much?
I don't know. And my,
it's almost like you're proud that you've had sex. Maybe you are subconsciously. It's like some
proud,
you think it's cool.
No, it's cool. I'm 43.
It's weird to say, oh, I lost my virginity to this girl. When you say girl and you're 43,
I know
you were a boy when it happened, but
she was a woman.
There's something weird about saying that, hearing that.
Yeah,
you know
that's true. To this girl, as a middle-aged man saying,
yeah,
I guess so. I know. But you know, it was nice. It was a good person to have that experience with. I'll always really appreciate the way she did it, because obviously, if
she was gentle.
Yeah, and taught me stuff. It was like a good teacher.
How much older was she?
She was 4 years older.
Oh my God, I almost thought you said 40. Oh.
She was 40 years old. She was 65.
You know what we should talk about? The guest, Dan Harris.
Yes, I know.
I might be reading too much into it, knowing what I know about him. Not knowing that much about him, but knowing what he does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
He strikes me as the kind of person who is like a type A person who's chill.
Yes.
And he seems like someone who meditates to me. You know,
doesn't he? Yeah.
He seems very present.
I know he's got
patient.
Yes.
Part of that is like professionally he's good at that. He's good at interviews. Is that your stomach?
Yeah. It's the falafel I just ate. Because it's, you know, it's chickpeas.
Ooh, falafel.
So it's,
yeah.
I know.
That'll do a number.
It's protein and.
It's not a good thing to have right before you record.
I know. I shouldn't have done that. I was, but yeah, but not all of people in his position are as present and like connected. This is some humble bragging. I've done those shows though. Like, you know, we've done them for like Lady of the Manor. And you see there's a real degree.
There's a gradation.
Gradation for sure of like how present, connected somebody is in an interview. And I would argue that he is, I think most of them are, they're not all that like, they're not great listeners all the time. Also on those morning shows, they have things in their ear. People are talking to them. It's really hard to like stay focused. And
mm-hmm.
He's just so impressive. He's just such an impressive speaker. And he seems so like, I love how honest he is about, I mean, I love that we talk about that a lot on the show, but like he really, especially in the book, he gets into, I talk about warts and all.
Yeah.
And that's a really like difficult thing to overcome. I think he felt a lot of shame from that moment.
Yeah.
And he's used, I mean, what a great example of like turning lemons into lemonade, a colloquialism that he probably wouldn't use. He'd find something a lot smarter.
How much of that panic attack was, and you might not be able to answer this, but I was curious when he was talking about it, how much of it was drug-induced versus trauma-induced from his experiences overseas? Or do you think he couldn't say?
I wonder.
Was it like the night before? When he told the story, was it the night before he had?
What a great question.
He, you know, cocaine for 14 hours and was like spinning out.
Well, I think it's, you know, the
so maybe it was more of a physical thing than anything else.
Maybe. I think it is most, I think it starts, it's triggered by something physical. Like the only thing I can really relate it to is where I came closest to that in a professional way was when I was on stage and I was hungover. I had been drinking and stuff the night before, but it was an evening show. So I had the whole day to recover. And there was just, and I took this thing. Somebody gave me a pill that was like, oh, take this. It'll help with hangovers. And it made my stomach weird. And that then triggered severe anxiety, like an anxiety response in my head, which was this, which was, oh my God, you're on stage. Like I couldn't get off stage. I was nauseous. I was going to throw up. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the anxiety became. That he talks about this in a lot, is the stories that you tell yourself. You tell yourself a story. Mm-hmm. And the story I was telling myself was that I was going to throw up and embarrass myself on a, that's right, Broadway stage. And that was, of course, I didn't, but that's what you start spinning out about. That's what, like.
Oh, because the stakes are high.
Yeah.
They were high for him when he had
Diane Sawyer right yeah. there. Like, oh my God, Charles Gibson. Like, I can't imagine.
Would have been scarier if it was Peter Jennings.
Yes. That was another revelation about the book was and my talk with him today, how intimidating he was. But it makes sense, doesn't it?
Kind of. What surprised me, though, was his temper. Because my association, his temper.
His
temper. And kind of like...
Hostility, kind of.
Snarkiness.
Yes, I know.
I don't know what word you'd use, but...
Bitchiness? Yeah. You wouldn't say that to his face.
Sure wouldn't. My association with Peter Jennings is so pure, you know, because we were kids, and he was... He was the news anchor. He was like our Walter Cronkite. Yes. When I think of him,
God, so stable.
Stable and even keeled.
Yes.
And
authoritative.
Wise.
Yeah.
And not at all. I can't imagine that version of him in my brain being like, oh, you're going to wear that? Like, nice suit, loser.
I can't imagine.
It's
like trying to imagine Rick Moranis or like John Candy being like unfunny.
Yeah.
You know? It's like...
Or a jerk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's so hard to imagine. Or both. An unfunny jerk. yeah, you're right. He's so solid. You don't both have to think of Peter Jennings as a pillar of stability and authoritative decisiveness. He was like that. He was the guy that you trusted.
Completely.
And like would never like fly off the handle. I can't imagine.
And he had competition back in the day. You know, there was Tom Brokaw.
Dan Rather,
yep. Ted Koppel.
Diane Sawyer.
Yeah. There was competition, but I always liked Peter Jennings the best.
You don't bother to like Peter Jennings the best out of all those authoritative news anchors.
You don't have to watch Peter Jennings because your father watched him and liked him.
He was also, I don't know how to say this. This must speak to some of my brain being somewhere on the Kinsey scale. He was also like the most handsome.
Here we go again.
Oh boy.
Okay.
Is that part of it?
Was he the most handsome?
Ted Koppel?
I mean, yeah.
Tom Brokaw was pretty handsome.
He was.
I might put Tom Brokaw ahead of, but he, yeah.
Chuck Fucker Mary with the iconic news anchors from the 80s and 90s.
Who would you do? Who would you? Not including Diane Sawyer. Let's say it's all men. It'll make it easier.
No, much easier. Much easier for you.
Oh, well, who cares? Times are changing.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Stop trying to
out myself.
Co-opt the bisexual movement.
Jeez, I hope people don't think I am. But it's
why? What's wrong with that? What would be wrong with that?
Oh, man. Oh, no.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to get out.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wonder if Dan Harris ever encounters that.
I would like to try his app.
I sent it to you.
No, I know. Don't yell at me. That's not the way to encourage meditation.
By the way, it's not. Yeah, that's true. That's not a good example of how meditation's helped me.
Because as he was talking about it, I realized pretty firmly that, oh, this is right up my alley.
Yeah.
Like in a lot of ways, because I think, oh, gross.
That went right out of my alley.
And this is a small room, you know.
I know. Well.
Because a lot of the things he was talking about like your brain going and thinking about all these other things, I think I've just gotten used to doing that in my life, and that's become normal in my brain. Because I have a very consistent undercurrent of anxiety
yeah.
in my life.
Yeah.
that I've just gotten very used to.
Yeah, you think, well, that's...
And, like, it's normal.
Right.
But yeah. When you hear someone talk about that, and it sounds like something you do, you realize that just because you've gotten used to something doesn't make it normal, and it doesn't mean there's not a way to combat it.
I am so excited for you, because that is the exact type of mindset that you need to get into this. It's a way to help you understand your reactivity, how to not be reactive to
What's
this.
That supposed to mean?
Like, well, what I just did with you, too. But, like, when you get a text, for example, that let's say it's from a parent who might say something that is kind of triggering, it teaches you to just put it down. Put it down, set it aside.
The phone or the whole thing?
Both. The whole, and process. Sit with the uncomfortable. Sit with how you feel about it. It doesn't tell you not to feel.
I was curious about why he left his position at ABC News to focus on the meditation app beyond the obvious, which is
money.
That it was doing well and he's passionate about it. Mm-hmm. But I wondered what led to that full-time shift. And I wonder if he misses being a newsman and if he harbors any desire to go back to it at some point.
Yeah, those would be great questions for him.
Oh.
You know, I can, wish he had done the interview.
I'm just curious.
You know what, this is...
Because that's a pretty big jump.
Why didn't I ask him?
Especially for a guy who clearly is and talks about being very ambitious and driven.
I know, but you know what...
Just to give up, you know, decades of experience.
Not to defend my not asking him that, but I think I just assumed it was because he was so, he was so consumed with it. And it's the kind of thing where I think you... It does become your entire life, and the hours are crazy. And you know, he's got a family and stuff. And I think he probably saw the negative effects that it was having on him. You know, all of that anxiety and stuff.
Well, I guess we don't have to ask him now.
You know,
that's good.
I guess we'll never really.
It's
know,
a good theory,
truly, but that's my theory.
It's funny. I thought you did an excellent job with the interview, but at one point when he was explaining the idea of starting over in his own meditation, you interrupted him like 12 times.
God.
It was really funny.
That's funny. Oh, no.
Let's read a letter.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Efficient.
Okay. Jeez. Wow. All right. Trying not to crinkle it as much.
That was you trying not to crinkle it
yeah,
as much?
Well, not at the first part was I forgot about it. And then as became more conscious of it, here we go. From Cheyenne Batrick. Subject, peace shivers.
Ooh.
I like it already. Also, Cheyenne's a cool name. Hi! 3 exclamation points. Christian and Justin! 1 exclamation mark.
Point.
My name is Cheyenne. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I love when you guys talk about your love for Portland. Maybe one day we will run into each other.
I love Portland.
Longtime listener, first-time caller. I just finished watching Ted Lasso and love that line, I had to use it. I guess that's a line in Ted. Long time listener,
Ted
first
Lasso,
time.
Yeah.
I haven't either. First of all, you guys are so funny. Thank you, Cheyenne. I love your brother Chatter. I also enjoyed the episode of your grandma and love when you two talk about her. Oh, you guys have the coolest job. We do. And what a cool job. It is a really fun. We love. That's our favorite episode too. I just finished the David Copperfield episode and had to tell you my pee shiver story. Great. I was on a road trip with my one-year-old daughter, just the two of us, and I had to pee. I still had an hour to go on the trip, so I needed to stop, and I would also have to wake her up and take her into the bathroom with me while trying to pee. Anyways, while I was peeing, Amelia, my daughter, great name, also started to pee, which every time a baby pees, they usually shiver. Huh, I didn't know that. But at the same
time... You don't know that babies shiver when they pee.
But at the same time, the pee started coming out of her diaper and onto my leg. Luckily, that doesn't gross me out at all. Pee.
Not baby pee.
Yeah. Even people pee. I mean, unless it was like...
Some people
pee.
Yeah,
that's true. Ugh. Like a dehydrated, like stranger pee. Shit. Yeah, awful.
Anyway. Had like 6 cups of coffee.
Yeah, okay. And
asparagus.
Luckily, I had a change of clothes in the car, but such terrible timing. This is such a gross story. I can't believe I'm emailing you guys this, but anyways, long story short, Christian, babies pee shiver on the reg.
It's good to know.
Yeah, it is good to know.
And we were speculating about women.
That's right.
Pee shivering.
That's right. Babies do it. Huh?
Interesting. It's really good to know.
I relate to that too. I don't do it on the reg.
Like I don't either. I only do it when
long trip.
not necessarily a long trip, but I've been holding it in for a while.
Yeah. Anyways, on the topic of babies as a first-time parent, it's fun to hear would you rathers with a parenting theme. So here's mine. Would you rather take a baby on an 8-hour plane flight where he or she screams the whole flight? Oh, man. I know. I'm not looking forward to that. That's going to be something I have to use meditation for, really. That's going to come in handy.
Well, you don't have a baby, so you don't have to really worry about it at the moment.
I know, but I'm saying, like, hypothetical. Uh-huh. Okay, either that 8-hour flight where she's screaming, oof, boy, or where he or she is quiet but poops and spits up every hour of the flight. Definitely be
second one, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially because from my experience of baby poop, it's not bad.
Yeah, and...
And spit up's not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not great, but it's not like it'll... You know, infect the whole plane.
That's
so it's
true.
Not like other people are going to be mad at you.
That's true.
Even though they shouldn't be mad at you if the baby's crying. But I think I know my personality enough to know that I would feel bad, guilty and bad if my baby, if my hypothetical baby was making a lot of noise and disrupting people.
It'd be constant.
They would be assholes to get mad at me, I think.
I know.
But I would still feel bad, I think.
I would too. Yeah, definitely be. Good hypothetical. I think for me it would just be a constant source of anxiety as well. The screaming.
Yeah.
And I know you get used to it and all that, and I'm sure by that point I will have gotten used to it a little bit more. A baby screaming in public, and you know, it's like, what can you do?
Oof, I don't know.
But I always get annoyed when even with my meditation, I think I had that recently. A baby was crying on the whole flight, and it was about an 8-hour flight. It was across the Atlantic. And so
man, I don't know. I love our nephews and I love meeting like my friends' kids and stuff. But when I'm in the grocery store or in any sort of public place and I see kids who are carrying on and I look at their parents and they seem like at their wit's end, I always have this feeling of, oof, kind of glad I'm not doing that right now.
I know.
I mean, obviously, there are so many good things about it. Yeah. I don't mean to parent shame, but I'm just being honest that seems really unappealing to me.
Well, your honesty is really appreciated.
Good.
And we don't have any frame of reference. We don't know the other side. We don't know the beauty of it and the joy.
So I'm sure if you have your own kid, you get so much joy from that all the bad stuff seems worth it.
So
I can only imagine.
Yeah, and I'm sure Cheyenne can attest to that. And Dan Harris can, too, because he has kids.
He has a little child. I think he has one child.
One child.
You kept saying kids, plural,
really?
And he didn't correct you.
Huh.
But I believe he has one boy.
He's probably really good at, like, discerning what needs to be corrected. And,
yes.
Well, yeah. Anyway, I hope to get there one day.
You will.
Yeah. It's a learning process. That's the nice thing about the show and life in general and beginning again.
Amen. So thank you, Cheyenne. And if you guys would like to write in, our email address is lifeisshort@wondery.com. So thanks to Cheyenne and to Dan Harris. I can't wait to, if you're listening, I can't wait to read your book and download your app.
And you should.
10%.
Yeah, 10%. Check it out. And we will talk to you soon.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-boo.
Life is Short is hosted by me, Justin Long. It is co-hosted by you,
Christian Long.
Also a producer. Another producer is Megan
V.
Monaco and
Katie
V.
Allen.
Senior producer is
Michelle
Mish
Lance.
And the audio engineer is
Sergio Enriquez.
The executive producer is
Marshall Louis.
And all of it is for a company that is called
Wondery.
Do, 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 shaboo.
You mean there are a lot of rabbits around?
What?
There are a lot of rabbits?
Yeah, did you see the rabbits today?
No. By the garden?
I haven't seen the rabbits. They were there. Did you remember like that slaps term?
Yeah.
Slaps.
What does that mean? Oh yeah.
Wendy.
Oh yeah, what is have you heard of the word slap? The term slaps?
Like that slaps?
No. It's just for a slap.
Right, but it's a new slang for
what?
It means something's really, it's really good. It's
a
good
thing.
I was
going to say, guess.
I've heard that one.
Oh.
Like,
slaps, something slaps.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you just use the vocabulary that we have?
Well, no, no, no. You know, every once in a while,
there's always evolving.
Yeah, it's always changing.
Slacks.
Now, I'm sure you had a word. Now you use it. Your parents didn't use. Like this, that's
like
boss.
That's
or like that's.
Oh, we had boss. In the
yeah, home. Your parents probably would have been like boss. Why not just say that's good? You know.
Boss or rad.
Yeah, rad. That was more 80s, I thought.
Yeah, boss was more.
Or like slaps.
All right. And what
cool.
were the insults?
Well, I was cool.
Cool. Yeah, they didn't use... Grandma didn't say cool.
Oh, she would have said hep.
Hep?
I think in the 40s they would say hep. Well, that's really hep.
That was hep.
No.
I was like hep cats.
The 60s.
Hep cats over you.
Hep is a 40s. Mm.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Life is Short ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that yeah. I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.